Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our radio and online audiences. It's my great pleasure to introduce Professor Mary Doino, who will be speaking tonight upon the topic Civil Saints and Civic Pride in the Renaissance City-State. She had a very interesting idea about the competitiveness among Renaissance city-states like Florence, Pisa, Siena, Venice, and so on and so forth, and how they competed. And not only did they compete in art, and we've got Michelangelo, who do you have, that kind of stuff, but they also competed with their patron saints. What an interesting idea. Thank you very much.
Thank you, George. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for coming out. It's great to see you. In June 1311, Duccio di Boninsegna completed his monumental altarpiece, the Maestà. An anonymous 14th century chronicler described the procession that accompanied its installation on the high altar of the cathedral. On the day on which it was carried to the Duomo, the shops were locked up, and the bishop ordered a great and devoted company of priests and friars with a solemn procession, accompanied by the signori of the nine and all the officials of the commune and all the populace. All the most wealthy were hand in hand next to the painting, with lights lit in their hands, and then behind were the women and children with much devotion. And they accompanied it from the Campo to the Duomo, as was the custom, sounding all the bells in glory, out of devotion, for such a noble painting was this. And all that day they remained in prayer with much alms, which they gave to poor persons, praying to God and his mother, who is our advocate, who defends us through her infinite mercy from every adversity and every evil, and guards us from the hands of traitors and enemies of Siena. The campo the chronicler refers to is, of course, the magnificent central piazza in Siena. The nine, or nove, as they were called, were the immensely effective rulers of Siena's civic government during the 13th and 14th centuries. The nine might be familiar to you because of their frescoed Sala dei Nove, their meeting room in Siena's Palazzo Pubblico, or communal palace, where Ambrogio Lorenzetti's 1338 frescoes vividly illustrate the glories of good government and the horrors of bad government. The custom that the chronicler refers to was the annual civic procession and festivities surrounding the August feast of the Assumption of the Virgin, the Cortero dei Ceri or dei Cenci, the procession of candles and tributes, the most important and lavishly celebrated holiday in Siena. During this procession, various members of the Sienese community traveled carrying identifying banners from the campo right here, up the hill to the city's cathedral or Duomo, and made offerings of candles and wax there to the city's patron, the Virgin Mary. In the Italian city-states, civic authorities took an active role in directing the spectacle of the procession, using these rituals as a simultaneous demonstration of obedience to the controlling authority, the civic government, and to the city's patron saint. Thus, the procession to mark the installation of Duccio's monumental altarpiece was imitating how Siena celebrated the feast of the Assumption, and by doing so, was dramatizing a symbolic resubmission of the lands and people that made up the commune, as well as a reaffirmation of the Virgin's sanction of the city. It was, in short, merging political and religious ideals in a very public manner. While it is impossible to say exactly when the Sienese began to venerate the Virgin as their patron saint, the civic cult clearly took on a fevered intensity after 1260. This was the year that Siena defeated Florence at the Battle of Monteperti, a victory that was as unexpected and astounding to the Sienese as it was to the Florentines. Siena credited its victory to the vows both civic and religious officials had made in front of images of the Virgin, like this one, although this one wasn't there yet, in Siena's cathedral on the eve of the battle. The Virgin, the Sienese would explain again and again, had so appreciated their devotion that she took a special interest in the people of this Tuscan city-state. To put it bluntly, the Virgin liked Siena more than she did Florence. 11 years before Duccio had completed his altarpiece, Siena's civic government, the Nine, had assumed control of the oppida, or the works administration of Siena's cathedral. This means that it was the civic government that not only had a direct hand in commissioning Duccio's painting, but also in organizing the festivities surrounding its installation. That hand seems to have been most focused on using the arrival of Duccio's painting at the cathedral to articulate the connection between the city's devotion to the Virgin and its political identity. By having the arrival of Duccio's painting mimic the annual procession the city undertook on the Feast of the Assumption, the Nine were using the cult of the Virgin to reinforce the value of their rule brought to the city. Just as the procession to mark the Feast of the Assumption ritually expressed the commune's power and the Virgin's divine sanction of the city, this procession to install Duccio's altarpiece also put forward a message of a divinely ordained civic identity. The content of the painting reinforces this argument. Duccio's Maestà transformed a traditional composition of Mary as the mother of God and Queen of Heaven, as you can see her seated here on a throne, into one that spoke specifically to the Virgin's role as patron and protector of Siena. He did this primarily through two details: the inscription along the edge of the Virgin's throne, which is almost impossible to make out in a slide, but you can make it out in person, and the placement of four ancient Sienese patron saints kneeling on either side of the Virgin. 1, 2, 3, 4 here. The inscription articulates the Virgin's role as civic protector by imploring her to, quote, be the cause of peace for Siena, and because he painted you thus, of life for Duccio. On either side of the Virgin, Saints Asano, and I have a detail here of Asano, Savino, Crescenzio, and Victor, other Sienese patrons who had been venerated in Siena's cathedral since at least the 12th century, dominate the panel's foreground. Both their prominent placement here and their gestures of submission and petition to the Virgin make it clear that the viewer is meant to understand Duccio's inscription here as the saint's own plea. In other words, this is what they are saying to the Virgin. These four saints are functioning as intermediaries between the people of Siena and their patron and protector. Duccio's is not the only Maestà you will find in Siena, however. Between 1315 and 1321, another Sienese painter, Simone Martini, created a Maestà panel, not for the cathedral, but rather for the Sala de Concilio within the Palazzo Pubblico, right here, or communal palace. The Sala de Concilio was the meeting room where Siena's larger governing body, the General Council, met. Martini's fresco largely copied the design of Duccio's altarpiece. Although Martini's painting never functioned as a formal altarpiece, its use as a backdrop for the meetings of the Commune's General Council went one step further in conveying the convergence of political and religious ideals that were first suggested in Duccio's panel. In what scholars believe once depicted a collective petition to the Virgin to protect the city, just like in the Duccio panel, each of the city's ancient patrons held scrolls with inscriptions that are no longer extant. And here we have our saints, our patron saints, 1, 2, 3, 4. And you can see that there are scrolls here. They're almost impossible to see, but that they were holding. Along the steps below the Virgin's throne, it is possible in person, not in a slide, right along here. It runs all the way along here. It's possible to still make out Mary's response to these petitions the saints had made on behalf of their devotees. The full inscription that survives reads, "My beloved, bear in mind, when your devotees make honest petitions, I will make them as content as you desire. But if the powerful do harm to the weak, weighing them down with shame or hurt, your prayers are not for these, nor for whoever deceives my land. The angelic flowers, the rose and lily, with which the heavenly field is adorned, do not delight me more than good counsel. But some I see who for their own estate despise me and deceive my land, and are most praised when they speak the worst. Whoever is condemned by this speech, take heed. The Virgin here has placed conditions on her protection of Siena. Martini's inscription portrays the Virgin not only as Siena's protector, but also as concerned with the nature of the city's government. Her praise for good counsel and condemnation of those who oppress her land or harm the weak tells the viewer that her protection and patronage of the city is dependent upon its identity as an ideal civic community. The argument, however, is essentially circular. The Virgin will only respond to pleas that aim to create a strong and well-governed city. However, her role as the city's patron and protector and patron ensures that Siena can be nothing but a strong and well-governed city. The relationship we see these Maesta panels drawing between Saint's political identity and its cult of the Virgin, Siena's political identity and its cult of the Virgin, speaks to the quintessential role patron saints played in forming civic identity in the late medieval and Renaissance city-state. Patron saints protected their cities at the same time as that protection served as an endorsement of a city's particular political, social, and religious identity. The irony behind the growth of the cult of patron saints is that it is at exactly the moment when cities stopped being controlled by their bishops and began to be controlled by their lay population, that is exactly at the moment of the birth of the independent commune or city-state, that we see the most intense growth of patron saints' cults. And as was the case in Siena, while these saintly cults did not appear out of the blue, as the identity of civic governments changed from being largely ecclesiastical or church-dominated to being secular, patron saints began to take on much more of an explicit political role. In city-state after city-state, the cults of civic patrons grew in ways that aimed to make clear connections between the ways in which a patron saint specifically labored with God and the earthly well-being of his or her city. The patron saint therefore symbolized political power. The new lay rulers of the Italian city-states found that they had a much easier time demanding demonstrations of obedience from their citizens if they did so in the saint's name. To this end, we hear not only about how the Virgin protected Siena, but how the evangelist Mark's presence in Venice made it the Serenissima Repubblica, or the most serene republic, and John the Baptist ensured the power and success of Florence. There is no better place to begin tracing the important role John the Baptist played in the creation of medieval and Renaissance Florence's identity than to recognize the fact that it's the baptistry right here and not the cathedral that stands as the city's emblematic church. And just as was true in Siena, a crucial part of Florence coming to assert its identity as an independent city-state, that quintessentially Renaissance institution, was creating the cult of a patron saint and connecting the maintenance of that cult to its civic government. Florentines did this largely through the stories they told themselves about their civic history. They prided themselves on the notion that they were early adopters of Christianity and would claim throughout the Middle Ages and Renaissance that the city converted to Christianity during the reign of Constantine. It was at this time, Florentines believe, that the city took John the Baptist to replace the Roman god Mars as the city's protector, and that they began to build their baptistry, a detail here, to replace Mars's pagan temple, which we know stood on this site. Here we have an image of Lorenzetti Lorenzo Ghiberti's 1412 bronze sculpture of John outside the church of the Ora San Michele. A laud or public praise popular in the 14th century, a century before Ghiberti's bronze, makes clear how Florentines saw the city's peace and civic freedom as chief components of John's guardianship. Blessed be our protector. In the divine heavens, St. John the Baptist, who with zealous love has always prayed for his Florentine people. And so much did he and does he love his children that he has liberated them from war and pain. Medieval and Renaissance Florentines would be quick to point to a series of historical events as evidence of how John's particular concern and care for the city had maintained its health and freedom. To name just a few, the Goths were defeated in the city on the Baptist June 24th feast day in 401. The city had officially become an independent city-state when in the 12th century its feudal lords made a symbolic show of their submission by giving offerings of wax at John's altar in the baptistry. And finally, in 1253, prayers to John kept a 70-meter tower from collapsing onto the city. Florentines also made use of John's role as the Baptist to solidify the meaning of his civic cult. The baptisms that took place in John's magnificent baptistry were understood to ensure the social cohesion of the city. Florentines saw these baptisms as forming a common civic bond among all citizens, along with facilitating the more specific familial alliances created by godparentage. Godparents, or compari, could function to broaden the Florentine family beyond the usual confines of neighborhood or class, creating or reinforcing social connections that would be quite beneficial in the worldly realms of politics and business. While Florentine civic ideology helped shape the cult of her patron, rituals connected with John's cult constituted an instrumental force in the formation of social identity and power. And when particular families aimed to rule the city, they would use John to help assert their authority. A key example of this can be seen in the Medici family altarpiece painted by Fra Filippo Lippi in 1457. Here we can see the appearance of the child John the Baptist, what scholars call the Giovannino, in a panel depicting the Virgin adoring the Christ child. As art historians have argued, the representations of the child John the Baptist, which became ubiquitous in Florentine art beginning in the late 15th century, cannot just be explained as a stylistic development. It had a broader social context and content that connected youth with redemption and salvation, ideals the Medici family wanted Florentines to associate with their rise to power in the city. And finally, no story of the importance patron saints played in the creation of civic identity would be complete without some time spent with the myth of Venice. Here we are looking at that iconic Venetian panel, Giovanni Bellini's 1496 procession in St. Mark's Square. The myth of Venice held that this Italian city's perfect constitution, as well as its pious, dutiful, self-effacing citizens, had everything to do with the strength, protection, and honor given to them by their patron, the evangelist Mark. No matter that Mark's remains did not arrive in Venice until the 9th century, when he was, quote, rescued, or really stolen, by two Venetian merchants who had heard that his tomb was being neglected and was in danger of being destroyed by the ruling caliph of Alexandria. Carpaccio's Lion of St. Mark, painted in 1516, nicely encapsulates how the Venetians' veneration of the evangelist as their civic patron contributed to how they thought of themselves as a distinct and, of course, most civilized people. Painted for a government office, Mark here is represented as a lion. Although clearly an imposing figure, Mark the Lion makes his peaceful intentions clear with the inscription on the book that he holds, Pax tibi Marque Evangelista Meus. Peace unto you, Mark, my evangelist. Beginning in the 13th century, Venetians circulated stories about how once during Mark's lifetime, as he was passing through the Venetian lagoon, an angel had said these words to him. And as any Venetian would know, the angel's message concluded by noting, "Hic requiescit corpus tuum," here your body will rest. As the angel's message makes clear, it was God who had designated Venice as the saint's final resting place, and by extension, set in motion the city's holy character. Despite the rather nefarious manner in which his remains arrived in Venice, this story crafted an argument of the city's divine predestination. Venetians were always meant to have Mark, acting as their protector and patron. Carpaccio's lion makes the meaning of that patronage and protection of the city clear. The lion stands with his front paws on the land and his hind paws in the water, expressing Venice's domination over both land and sea. Behind him, we see the sources of Venetian justice and prosperity, the ducal palace here, the seat of government and law, as well as sea-going galleys here that have made Venice Europe's leading port city. It is Mark's presence within Venice, this painting argues, that ensures the Venetian identity, a powerful yet serene city committed to maintaining justice and wealth for all of its citizens. In the early 16th century, the humanist Giovanni Flaminio, talking not about one particular patron saint, but about the urban patron in general, wrote, "We can see that by the great gift of heaven, it has come about that every city has been divinely allotted some saint as guardian and protector. Rightly, it awards him honor and worship at all times, but especially in uncertain or dangerous circumstances, it has recourse to him as protector and defender. This is so well known in all cities that there is no need to give examples. For although it can be believed that all those blessed spirits which enjoy eternity with angels care for Christians everywhere, it is nonetheless piously to be believed that there are very many of them who exercise a special care and protection over those places in which they were born, or where they lived for a long time, or suffered dire tortures and death for Christ. Or there are those, albeit foreign, whom the cities themselves have chosen as their patrons with a special cult and devotion." As this quick tour through Siena's cult of the Virgin, the Florentines' devotion to John the Baptist, and Venetians' love of the evangelist Mark has, I hope, made clear, patron saints were crucial to the creation of civic identity in the later Middle Ages and Renaissance. Each city told itself stories about the exclusive relationship that existed between its saint and its government, between its saint and its way of life, between its saint and its very identity as a people. Patron saints allowed cities to maintain and extend their identity in the midst of political upheaval. And while we may think of the Renaissance city-state as special for its ability to establish independent governments outside the control of the church, or for its embrace of classical ideals, we would be wrong to overlook how much of the identity of these Italian cities rested on an understanding of the special role played by a patron saint. It was the patron who, as Giovanni Flaminio notes, exercised a special care and protection over its city, who was divinely allotted to promote at the same time as sanction what it meant to be Sienese, Florentine, or Venetian. Thank you.
I'd like to remind our radio and online audiences that are listening to Mary Doino at the Commonwealth Club speaking about civil saints in Renaissance city-states. And my first question is, The Prince was written by Machiavelli only 100 or 150 years after this kind of switch to secular thing got started. And he obviously thinks that the princes are putting this all on to what extent do you think that the rulers, the secular rulers, just thought they needed this or that they were sincere about it? And I'm sure there was at least a little bit of both, but what percentages?
Yeah, that's hard to give actual percentages. I think you have to say that it's both at the same time, that there's clearly a way in which they're manipulating the saints and that they know that they're manipulating the saints, but it's hard for me not to feel that there was also sincere devotion to the saints, because the kind of idea of what it meant to be Sienese or to be Venetian was so entrenched in a love of these saints. I think it would be hard for a ruler not to feel themselves to be truly, if to be truly Sienese meant that the Virgin loved you and you loved the Virgin, right? That was part of the identity. And you might have also had thought, well, it's going to serve me well to kind of promote her cult at the same time. So I think absolutely both at the same time.
So, questions? There is another.
Thank you for such a fascinating topic. So many, obviously you focused on three Italian city-states. The Roman Empire, you know, encompassed great more than just Italy, but they had their own civil saints and civil gods as well. Mm. And I'm wondering how you feel or don't feel that maybe the saints, the ones you've mentioned and others, have maybe grown out of the old civil or civic god cults for sure. The same cities.
Sure. I think there's absolutely a connection between the kind of cult that rose in the Roman Empire, specifically cults on the kind of cult of the emperor himself, that the emperor was seen, especially with people like Constantine, that he was seen as kind of a divine figure, and that his divinity did this kind of circular argument where his divine figure ensured that Rome was being ruled well and that Rome loved him because he was a divine figure. I think without a doubt, the kind of cult of patron saints comes out of that, that there is a relationship with that. Absolutely.
Do you think there are any particular city-states where there's a more obvious relationship between the Roman era cult god and the more Renaissance era?
That's really interesting. I mean, I think there you have to think about the way in which so many Christian places of worship, just as we saw with the baptistry, were put exactly on spots where there were pagan cults, where there was a temple to Mars. So I think the continuity of a space itself as seen as a kind of particularly holy space absolutely remained. And to a certain extent, the person that's being venerated there is just kind of switched out, right? We go from paganism to Christianity. So we take Mars out and we put John the Baptist in. The continuity beyond that, it's hard to say, because I think when you're thinking about the kind of Christian cult of saints, and especially patron saints within a city, it's about an exclusive relationship between the city and one person. And I think with older cults, there could be a kind of variety of cults in one city. So Florence might have a temple to Mars, but Florence might also have a particular love of other pagan saints and have other temples to those saints. But in Siena, you're going, even though there are kind of lesser patrons, as you saw in the Maiesta altarpiece, where you've got Victor and Savino and Crescenzio, there is a kind of hierarchy there. So the Virgin is the head saint. And I don't think you necessarily have quite the same hierarchy when you're talking about pagan saint or pagan cults. Thanks.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is essentially kind of goes more on the political side.
Yeah.
You know, at this point in history, there's a lot of like dueling families that would come to power and try to knock off their, you know, rival family and things like that. And my question is, if you're aware of any cases where maybe a new family or a new group came to power and then tried to, you know, change over the patron saint or tried to establish their own family ones as a way to kind of solidify and, you know, entrench their own new power base.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I think it would take a lot of chutzpah for them to get rid of a saint that was already really kind of established. And you don't see ruling families do that. But what's interesting is in one case in Lucca, in another Tuscan city, there is a family that kind of comes to power at a particular moment in the 14th century, and they actually had a domestic servant, a woman that worked in their house, that, you know, was a contemporary, that had a cult that was, she was seen as a particularly pious woman. This cult develops around her. Her name is Zita of Lucca.
And they, after she dies, I think to everyone's surprise, this kind of popular cult arises and people start venerating her. And so you see this family use a kind, creating a kind of tomb for her, a whole chapel to her, as a way to kind of increase their power. But at the same time, they're not going to decrease interest in the city's patron saint. But you do see, absolutely, you see families kind of push, whether they're contemporary saints or if a family had a particular kind of association with the Virgin Mary or John the Baptist or some other saint, that they'll kind of increase their kind of veneration of that person if they see that it's kind of has a popular impact. If other people are interested in that, it will give them power and they'll push it. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here and being present and the research that you've done in articulating the points and the importance of identity and saints. Mm. That's and the word quintessence, I think you use, which I love the context of it. I have a lot of questions. I think many of them have been answered already, but I have also done some research on patron saints, and of course there's a thousand versions that can be rendered. As you, I'm sure, would agree. I guess one of the things that comes up for me is the work that I've done and am doing on Louisiana and each city having its own saint.
Yeah.
And I know that's broad, and you really have gotten an incredible locus.
Mm.
So I really appreciate how you've anchored the Italian centric, if you will, with respect to saints.
Yeah.
It really helps to give meaning to all the broader brushstrokes of patron saints.
Yeah. Yeah.
So again, that's like the $1 million thing you've done here. So Louisiana, there is a saint that I'm doing research on, and her name is, and I hope I pronounce it, I'm sure you know who she is, Henrietta Delia.
Okay, no, I don't know. I've not heard of her. No,
she was a slave.
Okay,
and she was known to protect and protects those who were enslaved.
Yeah,
and then I want to just mention, I can't think of the church right now. It's all escaping me because I'm still taking in your presentation, which is pretty profound. But I just want to put a footnote on the deeper implications of slave history as a footnote and the power that saints had, Saint Martin de Porres, whom is right here, and on this necklace, and jumping in time or moving back, Teresa of Lisieux,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to stop, and Mother Teresa, et cetera, et cetera, and the Virgin de Guadalupe.
Yes,
so
yes.
Anything that you can say to that would be...
Yeah, it's. I mean, you've brought up a fascinating topic. Fascinating. I mean, it's outside of my area of expertise, but I think what you're touching on, which is so interesting, is the fact that saints can be used in all kinds of different political circumstances, political and social circumstances, right? They can be symbols of resistance, right? Of resistance from oppression, right? In terms of a kind of of a slave saint or an image that slaves look to. It can be used in terms of kind of colonialism when you think of the Virgin of Guadalupe, that it was very much used as a way to kind of push kind of Spanish power in the kind of taking over of the Americas. So there is, in a certain way, it is a very kind of a broad canvas where you can write on it whatever kind of political or social issue you have, and I think that you're seeing that in your own work, and this is in some ways the kind of birth of it, that we see it kind of taking shape here. Thank you.
Yeah, I grew up in
I
grew up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was a working class town that had a lot of immigration in the 1880s.
Yeah,
and then when I went to New York, I moved to Jersey City, which is right across the street from there. Also, the same thing, a working class town. The immigration was from the 1880s, and what I found fascinating was all of the Catholic parishes for the different groups were exactly the same names in both both these towns separated by 1,000 miles. Yeah. St. Casimir was for the Polish.
Right.
Holy Rosary was for the Italians.
Right.
Et cetera, et cetera. Just, yeah. It was almost exactly the same. There was only two differences out of 15 parishes.
Yeah.
And that shows that hundreds of years after people had left their places, that they still did the same thing.
It becomes an identifier, absolutely.
No, thank you. This is a great topic. It was really interesting to learn more about it. My question was around how the church and the ecclesiastical institution supported or reacted to these cults. Because you mentioned that they were mostly formed as a result of the governments becoming more secularized. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I'm curious to see if it was a way for the secular government to maintain power away from the church, or if it was still a source of contention and ongoing struggle throughout, and how that worked.
It's absolutely a source of contention. I mean, every city has its own story, but, you know, the Maestà panel is being put in the cathedral, and there's still an episcopal authority. There's still a bishop of Siena, and even though he feels that his power has really been taken away from him, he doesn't want to kind of miss out on the show that the commune, that the secular government is putting on. So it's a kind of delicate kind of relationship that they have to build. But we have all kinds of evidence of when that relationship broke down. And oftentimes, specifically around the kind of rituals associated with saints. And they can get, I mean, just in some ways, the documents are hilarious. I mean, it sounds like a kind of like a city hall or a city, a kind of government kind of spat where, you know, the bishop will be saying, no, I'm going to walk first in the procession, and you guys are going to walk after me. I'm going to hold the panel, and you guys have to walk behind me. I mean, it was very much a way of who's going to, in these kind of very ritualized showings, who is going to show to have the power. But nobody can be gotten rid of, right? Because, I mean, I think that's what's so interesting. You can't totally efface the bishop, and you can't efface the secular government, because the whole idea of what the patron saint is doing is it's sanctioning the city, and the city is both put together, right? You can't get rid of one, or you don't have a city. Thank you.
Hi, I was wondering, I generally have lots of questions.
Yeah.
Had in any of the major cities in like a time period of like crisis, was there anything that was able to maybe shake the foundations of people's devotion to the saints? Mm. The immediate thing that to me would come to mind would be the plague.
The plague, sure.
And, you know,
well, what you see,
they gave up on the saints if they
They don't. What happens is that we have new saints coming up, right? So a saint like Saint Roch or Saint Rocco, who became very associated with the plague, right? People would pray to him, and there was a belief that he helped kind of get rid of the plague. All of a sudden, he kind of rises in popularity. So you just see a kind of popularity shift with saints. So maybe, you know, if the Virgin wasn't doing her job, she wouldn't be demoted, but maybe you wouldn't get quite as many processions or quite as many kind of candles put in front of her altars. But you would, all of a sudden, San Rocco would get an entire new chapel dedicated to him. So you see the popularity change. Again, it's a way of trying to explain things. So you never see exactly the explanation be, well, forget the saints, right? They're not doing their job. We're just going to not have them. It's just kind of shifting allegiances. We haven't been praying to the right ones. Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, in a secular society, trying to get rid of some of this ritual, you know, power shows, it never happens. You cannot get rid of it.
I mean, right.
You can have a 4th of July parade, and the Democratic Party will argue with the Republicans over, you know, which part of the parade do they go in, the beginning and the end.
Same thing.
Totally separate from that. I mean, I did mergers and acquisitions and legal ones, and the CEOs on one $10 billion deal fought for 3 days at a very high cost over what paragraph in the press release they were being mentioned. And they just said something, you know, innocuous. But the one who was more important, was in the third paragraph. That's the part of the ritual.
Right.
And the one who was subordinate to him in the merger was always relegated to the fifth, sixth, or seventh paragraph. and the power of the other one is shown by how far down in the press release the other one's name is mentioned. And seriously, they fought over for 3 days when everything else was done.
Wow.
And settled on the sixth paragraph. But, you know, so these things invade every, so it's more, I think, the power relationship between people, and that this is expressed in whatever the culture is. And I have a question for you about John the Baptist.
Yeah.
Now, John the Baptist is an odd saint in that he was born before Jesus.
Right.
As a Christian saint, he died before he was resurrected and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But, of course, obviously, they could say he was the first Christian, but he hasn't been used a lot.
Mm.
You know, in Christian religion, there's plenty of other people used that come later.
Yeah.
So how did they pick John the Baptist? Do you know?
Oh, God, that's a really good question. I mean, that in some ways is the million-dollar question. It's a question that people ask about Siena, too. Why does Siena pick the Virgin? You know, why does each city go to one particular saint? Yeah. And I hate to say it, I don't know.
No
I
evidence.
Wish I knew. Yeah. Yeah, we just don't have exact evidence. I mean, you could start to try to make comparisons. Well, Mars is kind of powerful. John the Baptist was seen as kind of powerful. I mean, but it gets a little bit tenuous. You can't quite make those arguments.
Mark is clear because it was predicted that he was another goon.
Well,
right?
but that story doesn't come about until the third. Yeah, exactly.
When you talk about civic saints, I was just hearing on KALW, our local public radio program, a discussion or a documentary about high schools needing to change their teams from Redskins.
Sure. Absolutely. Sure.
And one community in Idaho, no one would allow that to happen. People were getting up and saying, my grandmother
was a Redskin.
Right. You can't get rid of it.
Right. Right. Oh, that's so interesting because it's so, even though I'm sure many of those people might say, oh, yes, it is offensive. You know, they would see the kind of offensiveness of that kind of symbol. It's ingrained. It's who they are. Right. So it really comes to stand for identity. I think that's a great comment.
That's very interesting how our sports teams have taken over this ritual rule.
Sure. Sure. To who you are.
Everybody's saying how wonderful we did when, you know, they're just watching.
Hi, George Lundberg here. In the tally of saints over the ages, how many have there been?
Oh, that is so, so many. I should know the answer to that, but thousands at least.
Thousands?
Yeah, there are a lot.
And have the criteria for sainthoods changed over the years?
Absolutely, yes. Yes,
have
and
they
actually,
become more rigid or less rigid, or does it vacillate?
More rigid. I mean, what's so interesting about the criteria is that it doesn't come about until the 13th century. Before the 13th century, the Pope, the Church in Rome, really has no control over who's a saint and who's not a saint. You're a saint. Until the 13th century, you're a saint if people treat you as a saint. If people are venerating you, you're a saint, right? So and what's so interesting is that once the Church starts to come in and try to say, okay, well, they need to have this many miracles and they need to have done this and that and this, the Church has to kind of go back and try to make right all these local cults, right? So cities will say, well, we've been venerating this person for centuries. Are you kidding? And we don't have a record of how many miracles they've performed, and we're not going to stop venerating him. So the Church will kind of retroactively try to go back, and you'll see the creation of documents that says that there was this miracle, and oh, right, we remember there was this miracle, to make it official. But there's still tremendous numbers of saints in Italian cities that are within Catholic churches, that have altars, that have tombs, that are not recognized by the Church.
Yeah, the documentation of miracles.
Yeah.
Where is that kept?
Within the Vatican, right. I mean, there are documents.
Starting in the 14th century or?
Starting in the 13th century.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. You can go to the Vatican Library and read them, right? And there would be, and especially with saints that, people that lived from the 13th century on, so there would be people alive who knew them or who saw the miracles or witnessed people healed having gone to the tombs. We start to have these great documents of testimonials from these people. So someone from the Church will go and interview them and say, so you came to the tomb, you were limping, you sat at the tomb, you walked away from the tomb, and what happened? And then the person will say, and then I stopped limping, and it was because of the intercession of this saint.
Is backlash against the naming of saints a common phenomenon?
What do you mean by the naming of saints? Oh, of calling someone a saint.
Identification of saints. Calling somebody a saint. Like, the Pope was just here and named a new saint.
Yes, very controversially.
Who seemed to be a saint who made his sainthood out of slaughtering people.
Yeah.
So.
No, that was, I mean, it was a really interesting course of events, because in some ways it really doesn't go with the image that Francis has been putting forward. And I think you're seeing the kind of the bureaucracy of the Church was kind of got in front of Francis. Maybe that's one way of explaining it, that this was already set in motion. It takes so long for someone to become a saint that he couldn't have taken him kind of off of the
when was Saint
conveyor
Paul
belt.
Made a saint?
Well, That's a good question.
You're talking about 14th century. Oh, that's a long time before that, but maybe he's a more recently appointed.
St. Paul.
Yeah, St. Paul.
I mean, Paul's been seen as a saint from the beginning, but do we have actual documents?
There must have been a beginning of a sainthood. I mean, you don't just get born with it. Somebody had to decide that.
Well, it's really decided by people venerating them. So the beginning of saints is the story of martyrs in the Roman Empire, right? So the stories of people being killed by the Roman Empire for their Christian beliefs. That's the beginning of the cult of saints.
Yeah, Peter and Paul were both killed at Rome, mm-hmm. Before the first during the first century, and they were both considered saints right from the start.
Right.
So, the other question, there's a department at the Vatican that makes this decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a part of the bureaucracy that makes the decision. And they undid a few saints about 10 or 15 years
absolutely,
ago.
Absolutely, yes.
Christopher being one, the traveling one.
Barbara.
Because they found out it was just an old story, an old folk story from that area that they had then turned into a Christian story. And, and after 500 years of travelers all having that medal, on their things. Yes.
Yes, I know.
Yeah, exactly. we're very sorry about that, Pat. But anyway, it's an elaborate thing, and there's the venerable, right? There's two steps.
Mm-hmm,
if you have one miracle that's proved, then you get to the one step, and once you've had your second one, you can go to the next.
Mm-hmm.
And the Junipero Serra, Father Junipero Serra, who ran the things, I had a speaker here from the Indians who were against that about a year ago or so. And one of the things that they wanted to say was, don't do this. And there was a lot of a lot of protests about it.
Absolutely.
But I don't know if you saw what the Vatican's response to that was.
No.
That one of the important points about sainthood is that you're not perfect. that you're human and that you're not that you're that you're more holy than the average. But you don't have to be perfect to be a saint, or you wouldn't have any saints.
That was
one of their comebacks.
Thank you. Wow, how fascinating. And it's so easy to kind of go with all there because it's like, wow, history, 13th century. I wanted to just throw out to you, and I'm not certain how to articulate this question, but it's a time thing, as you know. The connection between, there's a few points that you made and raised, both of you, and with your presentation with me thinking of the relationship between the power of the Vatican, mm-hmm. if you will, now, mm-hmm. with the points that have been raised around naming popes, saints who were martyrs or, dictators or whatever, for lack of language. The city-states, the General Assembly, and I'm getting the General Estates,
mm-hmm.
the Third Assembly, and you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah,
yeah. Queen Antoinette and the power that the monarchies had.
Yeah, sure.
The queen and kingdoms had, and that shift and the relationship between where are we now in relationship to then and that split. Are you with
between
me? Remember the Fourth Estates and they
you're talking about the French Revolution.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you. So where are we not there? Again, I mean, there's this power shift.
Mm.
So it's more so a comment and then a question of time and where do you think we are politically and socially and culturally as a society with the power that Pope Francis has and then the loss of monarchies, i.e. example, Canada. What is it, Canada? They had this whole, Montreal had this big thing around the power of, the king and queens and Queen Elizabeth, et cetera.
Yeah.
Are you following?
That's a big question, and I wish I could answer. I mean, I think that what I can really answer is that I find it really interesting to see the kind of upswing and interest in the church again with Francis. Mm-hmm. The Catholic Church that we just had story after story about, losing members of the church and how people aren't interested in Christianity anymore. And all of a sudden there's this huge upswing. I mean, his trip out to the United States was incredibly popular. We see, story after story about how different Francis is. And for me, I love the fact that that there's this kind of revolution happening in the church, and he took the name Francis, right? So he is in many ways kind of imitating a revolution that happened in the church in the Middle Ages with Francis of Assisi. So there's a lot going on there that's quite interesting. Thank you.
So it doesn't take that much to be the revolutionary, you know, when you're in a traditionalist organization like that. So some of the stuff will still seem very traditional.
Right. I
think it'd be interesting, your bigger question about monarchy and everything. Humanities West, an organization which actually helped sponsor tonight's event, and which is going to have a program this weekend on the Renaissance, the early Renaissance, for 2 days at Marines Memorial. Last season, we did three programs. One of them on early Rome, Roman Republic and its end, then on Charlemagne, and then on World War I. And that's a basically a 2,000-year arc of the empire, the growth of monarchy, the movement of the center of power in Europe to the middle of Europe with Charlemagne, and then the destruction of all the empires at the end of World War I.
Yeah.
So we're about 100 years after the destruction of empire. There's still, you know, Queen Elizabeth, and there's still a few kings and queens, but they have almost no power left. But we do behave in our democracies as if we're still in a monarchy, in most of the things we do. Like, one of the things that was a monarchical trick was to make taxes as inconspicuous as possible and everywhere that they could so that they could collect as much money as they could without anybody noticing. Well, now we're taxing ourselves. Mm-hmm. You'd think we'd do it nice and straightforward and direct and not make it complicated, because that would be the lowest amount of money taxed. And so, but no, we do it exactly in the same sneaky way, because we haven't quite caught on. We're the ones doing it to ourselves, you know? And I think there's a lot of cultural things like that, that pervade our society that are still left over from monarchy. So you're asking, where are we? Yeah. In all these things, with patron saints and with sport, you know, going over to sports teams or movie stars, we don't have any princes or princesses in Europe. In all of the magazines, the magazines like the National Enquirer and People and so on, it's all about the princes and princesses who are still left and all their stories, and here it's all about our celebrities. It's the same thing. You need to have somebody to talk about, and what are they doing, and you have to feel they have an elevated life and also that they have really big problems as a result, so that you can be both happy that they're there and happy that you're you, at the same time, and not them. And that's why, you know, I think a lot of the stars certainly cooperate in this story making for us.
Sure.
So there's time for one or two more questions.
Well, this has been really fascinating as we've expanded on, you know, so far out.
Yes.
My question is actually a bit more kind of to the original things that we were talking about in the program. And essentially, you know, we're focusing from the Renaissance as a starting point as to when these venerations got bigger. And my question is essentially, do we have extensive records, you know, before the Renaissance of these cults around these saints? Or do you think it's more of the fact that as society got more developed, cities got bigger, and artistic and cultural ways of expression became more and more developed to the point where artists were better able to represent historical things or make sculptures that represent these people? Do you think it was that kind of greater artistic development that really made the veneration more possible, because they actually had a something you could point out and say, this is the saint, here's the picture, everyone can come see it, or here's the statue of the saint, we can now see it, and it's more tangible in a way that before it might have been more, you know, as a discussion type thing, because they just didn't have the artistic capabilities?
That's really interesting. I am a trained medievalist, so you won't get me saying that the Renaissance has more ability, right? So I'll say it's just different in the Middle Ages. Things look different. They're not necessarily worse, but they're different. What's interesting is that the documentation really gets going much, much more in, let's say, the 11th and 12th century. So we can't actually just point to the Renaissance is when all of a sudden we have the actual evidence, right? So we know a lot about the devotion to the Virgin earlier, but the key difference here, I think, is the way in which the political identity of these city-states changed. And that was a kind of late medieval Renaissance invention, the way in which it switched from being controlled by the bishop to being controlled by the urban laity, by the most prominent merchants and artisans, that they were taking control of it. So I think it's that political change and the money that came from that political change that could fund people, that could make such a spectacle like Duccio's Maesta and the procession that went along with it, that really kind of allowed this change to happen. So it is the Renaissance. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily documentation. It's more the need to mark this change or make sense of this political change and the money that was put behind trying to make sense of it. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Great question. Part of the interesting of the change is, of course, the money.
Yeah.
But if you look, say, at Ravenna, mm-hmm. which was the capital of the Byzantine Empire for a small amount of time in the 6th century, 6th or 7th century,
yeah.
The art there, which is the art in the churches, which is where the people are getting all their images from for all these things, is also very elaborate, totally different style, Byzantine style, and so on and so forth. But I think they all were there to tell the stories. I mean, I think that's what the churches were for. So I think that the kind of art that we admire because it goes back to the ancient times was also what was going on in the secular city-states. They were going back to the city-states of Greece, so on, and imitating
sure.
them. They were imitating their art, they were imitating their politics, they were imitating their secularness mm-hmm. after a long period of time when that wasn't. But I wouldn't think from the people's point of view, from the masses' point of view, it would have made much difference because they always had some art in the churches that told the stories
sure.
of that they wanted to be told. And there's something absolutely gorgeous about the mosaics in Ravenna, which is totally different style.
Yeah.
But I think if you look, that's one of the things that's great about Italy, right? There's all these different cities that were in power at different times and then never in power again. And so nobody destroyed
right.
what was there.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
you've got Ravenna from the 6th century, and you've got you go to Palermo yeah. and you see what it was like during the Crusaders, you know, in the 10th century, and so on. Because that's the only time they were in power, and their art just stays.
Mm.
And we get a little capsule of it, and I think that's great. It can't all be buried by Mount Vesuvius, and then
right.
we can just see what you know Pompeii was like exactly in 75.
Yeah.
So we're lucky that there was money and a period of time and no money after that.
There you go.
And that doesn't happen a lot, but it happened a lot in Italy to different city-states. So
exactly.
Thank you very, very much,
thank
Mary.
You.
That was
thank
great.
You so much. Thank you. Thank you.
So ends another enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 113th year of history.